This episode is made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Radio Meters program.
Hello, you are tuned into Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the unceded territory of the Musqueam people at UBC. My name is Alirad Amari, and I'm joined by my co-host today, Gurman Gill. Each week on Research Review, we interview a researcher who is affiliated with the UBC community and discuss some of their latest work and findings and how they relate to broader issues in society. Today, I would like to welcome Dr. Christopher Patterson to Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM. Dr. Patterson is an assistant professor in the Social Justice Institute at the University of British Columbia. His research focuses on trans-Pacific discourses of literature, games, and films through the lens of empire studies, queer theory, and creative writing. Dr. Patterson received his PhD in English from the University of Washington in 2013. So, great to have you on the show today.
Hi, it's great to be here.
Yeah. Could you start by maybe telling us a bit about yourself, your background, and how you got into your field of study?
Sure. So, like Alirad was saying, I'm Chris. I'm speaking to you from UBC campus on the ancestral and unceded territories of the Musqueam people. And I want to also acknowledge the labor that went into building this space, and as we can see, continues to go into it, and that allows me to be here today, historical and present, seen and unseen. And so I am the author of a couple books about race, mostly focused on trans-Pacific forms of empire. The first is called Transitive Cultures, and it deals with the ways that multiculturalism has grown, particularly out of British and American colonial projects in Malaya and the Philippines. And so it's kind of reversing the well-historicized notion that multiculturalism grows out of civil rights, when that's partially true, but there's a lot much longer history there. My second book, Open World Empire, is actually on video games, and it's focusing on, or it asks, I guess, how we can center Asian racializations and Asian labor in the making of games. Besides academic stuff, I'm also a fiction writer, and I write about racialized experiences and histories and possible futures. And my first novel is called Stamped, an Anti-Travel Novel. And that's about a bunch of young marginalized bozos who kind of live and travel in Asia. And then my second novel is called All Flowers Bloom, and that came out last year. And that's a queer speculative reimagining of racial histories and futures. But at UBC, I've been here for 3 years now, after living in Hong Kong and China for 5 years. And I've twice taught the Critical Racial Studies course, it's GRSJ 315, in the Social Justice Institute. So I suppose I have some experience teaching and researching critical race studies that I can talk to you about today. So that's me.
Yeah, that's awesome. We'll definitely get into a lot of your work later in the podcast, but let's start out with your work on critical race theory, since it is a bit of a hot topic right now. Could you maybe start by explaining to the audience exactly what that is?
That's a good place to start. And I should say that my own relationship with critical race theory is like, I 100% support critical race theory and it being taught and adapted. Though in my own work, I have critiqued critical race theory, as have a lot of scholars who think about race and are critical of race and all those things. So I don't technically identify as a scholar of critical race theory, but by kind of right-wing metrics these days, I definitely am a CRT scholar, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Because there's been such a kind of glossing over of like what that actually means in academia as a discipline versus like truth-telling about history and race, right? Which is basically what it means on like Fox News and so on. And so there's, I guess, like three different ways of thinking about what critical race theory is these days. And the first is that it's very broad. I guess this is something that I've picked up on more recently, like in the last 10 years. People use the term critical race theory in academia and otherwise to just kind of think about structures and systemic racism. So how white supremacy specifically is embedded in structures and institutions as opposed to just being individual. And so, of course, a lot of that comes from like the civil rights movement, civil rights law passing, but then still we still have racism, right? And so it's more of a question of like, so what did that do? What did that change? And how can we then think about the broader structures of things? And so it's broad, in its broadest sense, that's really what it's about. And it's taking all of these different theories of like post-colonial studies, cultural studies, and so on, in order to inform that. But in some circles, that's not really like a thing. That's just like good work, you know, like good social work or good humanities work sees structures and they see systems of racism, as opposed to needing, you know, a particular discipline to enforce it. And so that's one reason why it's gotten so weird these days, because it's used to term something that kind of everyone in academia, if they know what they're doing and they're well informed, is already doing and has been doing. It's not really something that you can attack, because it's just so shared, ideally, in an ideal sense, everyone's using it. And so then we have the kind of boogeyman critical race theory that we've been seeing a lot more of in the past year, especially in the last 3 or 4 months. Right before, you know, ex-President Trump got out of office, he was writing bills attacking any kind of critical race theory, or he signed an executive order, right, about this. And there's a much longer history to these boogeymen, right? It doesn't, and in a sense, that doesn't even matter. It doesn't have to be called critical race theory. It could be called almost anything. It used to be ethnic studies. It used to be queer theory at certain points. It used to be multiculturalism. And it doesn't really matter what it's called. It's just this, it's pretty much this very similar, if not the same, kind of threat to, you know, the quote unquote, the classics, going into schools, right? That there's this language about race going into schools that makes all white people seem racist and so on, which is something that's been repeated throughout North American history. And then just to wrap up, you also have the actual critical race theory, which we haven't talked about yet. But that's basically like the academic discipline that formed, again, after civil rights in the 70s and 80s. It's usually associated with this scholar named Derrick Bell, but we don't really have to go too far into that. And again, that was really like people in law questioning like how, why did civil rights not exactly work? Was there this huge backlash? How can we think about power in a more systemic, structural way? And so that is really critical race theory proper. And it was pretty niche until the 1990s. And it wasn't really original either, I should say that. Like, people had thought about this a long time throughout history in different ways. And by the 70s and 80s, it was mostly seen as a post-colonial studies thing. Though I think by the 90s, critical race theory started to grow as this alternative. And it's very into like U.S. law. And so that's why I would never really see myself as practicing it, because you have to have a pretty good sense of American law. And you have to also be very invested in American law, which I'm not really that much. Mm-hmm. So when I was a grad student, like in 2007, 2008, I would never call myself a critical race theorist, because that would be in a particular discipline at a particular time period. Whereas now we all kind of do, because it's a way that students recognize our work. And that media recognizes our work. But yeah, those are the three main ideas about it.
That's the thing, you know, right now I pulled up the critical race theory Wikipedia page just to like get a review. And it's pretty much, that's true. It's very American concept about like U.S. law, race in the U.S. And it was basically founded like in the 1970s, this ideology by American legal scholars.
Mm-hmm. Right, exactly. Yeah, it's a very specific time and place that it grows out of. But now that it's out there, you know, and now that people are kind of rallying against it and for it in different ways, we kind of have to deal with what it's become at this point. Yeah, and so it's changed into just one of those cultural wars terms that I'm sure we're going to see more often, you know, once September comes and people are back in classes. These things always leak into the classrooms in various ways. And so I think a lot of folks are thinking about how to strategize now that critical race theory is this much, much larger discourse and not really about the law anymore, but more about, yeah, structures of racism and white supremacy.
That's pretty interesting to hear. We'll be right back here on Research Review after one short message, so please stay tuned.
Without the help and support of our friends, we here at CITR wouldn't be able to bring you all the great music, art, cinema, and culture that you love. Thanks to the long-standing support from the Rio Theater, we are able to keep you informed on all the great artists, films, and everything else coming to town there. For all the current information about who and what's playing at the Rio Theater, visit their website at www.riotheater.ca.
You're listening to Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM. Today we are interviewing Dr. Christopher Patterson, and so far we've talked a little bit about critical race theory and what that is. So, Grimon, I think you had a question to ask.
Yeah, for the viewers listening right now who may not be familiar, there's currently a movement in the U.S., particularly from the right, to remove critical race theory education. Not necessarily like the law aspect of it. You can't really educate elementary school students on that, but just studies of race in general. What do you think would be some of the long-term consequences of that sort of a move?
Well, again, this isn't the first time by any means that this has happened. When I was in, I think it was right at the end of my grad school tenure, I think I was it was 2012 or 2013, when Arizona started to have bills against like ethnic studies, and then other states started to follow along to kind of ban ethnic studies. And they were successful in some universities actually in doing that. Now back then it was also focused on elementary schools, but now it seems to have stayed within that realm for the most part. Again, this is warning that everything could change by September. It could be a conversation more about universities than about elementary schools. Because COVID kind of saved people from talking about universities all that much. So just for the listeners who might not know, like, so right now there's huge campaigns by mass media, mostly right-wing associated media. And now there's legislation in like 24 different states that are all, I think they're all Republican governors in those states that are trying to ban its use, both in the government and in schools and things like police training and things like that. And so a lot of the way that critical race theory has leaked, particularly since Black Lives Matter in 2020, is that a lot of corporations are trying to play catch up, right? They want to see themselves as woke. They mm-hmm. They want their products to have a kind of, you know, anti-racist flair to it. And so one of the ways that they've done that is they've assigned certain books, like very popular books, that fall into a critical race theory kind of a discourse, and then they use that and they hire consultants to come in and try to educate their staff. And so there's been a lot of backlash to that. And I think some of the backlash is fine and expected, and it's part of that conversation. But then a lot of that backlash has also been about like, you know, you're restricting our speech and you're calling us all racist and it's just not true and all that kind of stuff. And so the reactions to that have basically been, you know, we need to save the children kind of things right now. That's where a lot of it's located now. How dare you call, you know, a 6-year-old white kid racist and that kind of thing. And it's also a reaction to retellings of history. The idea that the types of American and also Canadian history that people were taught in schools might be a bit flawed or might, you know, have some kind of fidelity or investment in the state and in narrating a particular kind of history. And so rather than see, you know, the kind of history that really propels people like Thomas Jefferson, who owned, you know, well over 100 slaves, and calling him, you know, a hero, instead of seeing that as propaganda, they see the idea that you would even mention that he had all those slaves is that itself is propaganda, even though it's totally true. It's very easy to prove. And so there was a project by the New York Times called the 1619 Project that won a Pulitzer Prize. So a lot of the reaction is to projects like that, like the ones that try to reform or abolish certain types of history because that history it has no evidence for it, or is just very propagandic. And so the kind of one of the really interesting ways that President Trump, for example, went on attack back in, I think it was September or November of last year, October, I think, he wrote an executive order basically banning critical race theory from the federal government so that they couldn't, you know, use it as a way to, they couldn't have the kind of disciplinary trainings and so on. And then immediately after, he was like, we're not going to do critical race theory anymore. Now, you know, because critical race theory says that American history is all propaganda, and that's just wrong. Of course, it's not propaganda. And so we're going to replace critical race theory with this thing called patriot. It's like patriot education, patriot-based education. And it didn't work at all because it was just so incredibly stupid. It was like, it was proving the critical race side right, right? It was like, this will prove that American history is not propaganda by starting a very propaganda type of education, literally called patriot education. And so one of the weird things about the right-wing attack on critical race theory now is that it kind of puts everyone's cards on the table. You know, it makes it very obvious who kind of hasn't done the work, I suppose, or who hasn't really thought about race, or who feels most defensive about it. And so to me, it's not very successful so far. I do see it as perhaps becoming more successful as once the universities all over the state start, and this conversation gets taken to different avenues. So I think so far the conversation has been very easy to kind of dismiss and just be like, it's not an interesting one. It's dumb. Nobody knows what they're talking about kind of thing. But as we always know, often like these horrible things start out as a joke or as something that we easily dismiss, and then they turn into something, you know, very threatening. And so we should be aware of that.
Now, you know, what do you think is the root of the discomfort that's like emerging around critical race theory? Do you think, you know, people actually have valid criticisms of critical race theory, or do you think this is something else that is being basically some other sort of tensions that are being like, basically, you know, critical race theory is sort of like the scapegoat for some issues that people are seeing?
Yeah, I mean, like I said, it's a lot of folks have criticized critical race theory on very legitimate grounds, I think, and I have too, because again, it's so focused on the US and so invested in US law. Whereas to a lot of and U.S. constitutional law particularly, right? Whereas for a lot of people, that's not really something that we invest all that much in or that much hope in, I should say. It's not a politics of abolishment, for example. Like there's critical race theory. It's again a huge thing, so a lot of people practice it. So I don't want to speak for everyone, but most of the time it's associated with like how do we reform certain institutions so that they can better be more diverse and serve people better, including like police and things like that. And so there's always been a lot of critiques of it coming from a more kind of leftist, I guess, position, including the fact that like critical race theory has nothing to say about war, almost nothing to say about war. You know, I'm half Filipino and my great grandparents came over as colonial subjects, not immigrants, because the Philippines was a colony for almost 50 years. I don't know how critical race theory would ever say anything about that because it's so focused on domestic US law. So there's just a lot of legitimate critiques out there.
Great. We'll be right back here on Research Review after just one short message, so please stay tuned.
UBC's Museum of Anthropology displays long-term and visiting exhibits of indigenous art from around the world, and guided tours are free. Our permanent collection features one of the world's finest exhibits of Northwest Coast First Nations art. Our collection includes 36,000 ethnographic pieces, 535,000 archaeological pieces, and over 600 pieces in the Kroner Ceramics Gallery. There's a lot to take in. Luckily, at the Museum of Anthropology, final exams are always take-home. If you've never checked out this world-class facility, now's your chance. The Museum of Anthropology is located right on campus and free for all UBC students and faculty. Come enjoy our collection and resources.
You're listening to Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM. My name is Alirod, and along with my co-host Gurman, today we are interviewing Dr. Christopher Patterson. So far in the past bit, we've talked a little bit about critical race theory and the controversy that has especially been surrounding this recently. For example, the controversy around teaching critical race theory in schools. Because, you know, when I see a lot of like the political stuff that's going on, especially you talk about like the Republican states, I feel like for a lot of people, you know, especially when you look at groups that have been historically advantaged, especially in U.S. society, you know, I would say like stifling these conversations or even, you know, like framing these conversations as dangerous, you know, and today, you know, they're saying critical race theory is dangerous. In the past, different names. In the future, they might say something else is dangerous. It's really a way for, I guess, people to protect the power and privilege they have.
Absolutely.
Like, those conversations, yeah. You know, they're those conversations inherently to a lot of people, they view it as threatening.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's the second part of the question that you asked, right? Is like, rather than just looking at the limits of critical race theory that we as academics and students often talk about, then there is the boogeyman of critical race theory and the reactions to it, which, like you're saying, is more about the fear of kind of, I mean, they say it's about a fear of indoctrination. I don't, I think you're right, though. It's more of a fear of losing privilege and power. And again, it reiterates a lot of the fears of like social justice warriors that I think was like a 2015, the fears of ethnic studies, fears of multiculturalism back in the 80s and 90s. So it's not all that different from those. It's just kind of a new name for some of it. Some of the ways I feel like it's, why is it happening now and in such force is like, it's a reaction partially to Black Lives Matter. And I think there are critiques that we can make of the way that, that Black Lives Matter has, not Black Lives Matter itself, but the way that it's been commodified and gentrified by companies and states. You know, I live right next to a Lululemon, for example, and, you know, they just had the Black Lives Matter hashtag on there right away. They had like Asian Lives Matter and things like that. Mm-hmm. Even though Lululemon was admittedly named Lululemon because the guy who named it thought it that Japanese people couldn't pronounce it, right? And so there's all of these weird racisms in these companies that they just refuse to reckon with, and instead they just wear the hashtag and have a diversity consultant come in.
Yeah, you know, it's pretty easy, I guess, for them to.
And they don't think about like where are the material resources coming from? How is that also participating in a more global sense with inequality and so on, and exploitation? You know, if every company that had the Black Lives Matter hashtag actually did a real reckoning with like where they get their resources, like where how things are manufactured, things would look very, very different, right? And so diversity consultancy is like actually a very completely surface level way to try and integrate the ideas of Black Lives Matter in the movement in order to create a kind of in order to sell better, right? And to have more products and to have more cultural capital. But besides all that, so that's not really your question, right? Your question was more about fear and coming from the right wing. And that is like the question, I think. It's the question about race in general. A lot of it's the question about America as, you know, I think Canada is also, the history of Canada is also a history of race, but definitely in the States, it's a history of race. And there's an exercise I like to do in my critical racial theories class just to kind of get folks to like think more broadly about race, and it's a weird one, so bear with me. So this exercise, I ask the students to think about a room that has 100 people in it, and the room is just the world, and they are white, and so they walk into the room and they see, look around the room, and they see like 25% of the room or so is East Asian, probably more than that, and then another 25% is South Asian. And then they look around and then there's Black people, and then there's, you know, different sorts of brown and indigenous people. And then they see like three, maybe four other white people in this room of like 100. And that would not mean anything, right? That wouldn't have any meaning to it whatsoever, except that there is this structural racism that pushes these three or four people to come together and see themselves as superior to the 95, 96 other people in the room. Right. And then I think that exercise is interesting because I've had students try to put themselves in that room and think about, you know, how would they relate to anybody else? Especially if they have so much privilege and power, like they would see 95% of that room as, you know, perhaps talking smack about them behind their back when they're not listening. But then whenever they try to talk to one of them, the person of color, you know, has offers to like take their jacket or something like that, like, how may I serve you kind of thing, and just smiles. And so there's this constant suspicion that like maybe they're not being honest with me. They're just treating me like this person of privilege and power and so on. And what my students eventually start to conclude is that eventually they develop a lot of fear of the people around them, you know, because of this power dynamic that exists in a room like that. And this fear of like, oh, we are the minority in the world, right? And that fear, as we know from Star Wars, I don't know why that's important, but fear leads, if it's like not dealt with, right? And if it's not really assessed, it can lead to anger and hate and things like that. And so that's where I think that's one way I try to get students to think about the larger question that you asked of like, where is this all coming from? And it, you know, it's not that hard to figure out, like in some of the right wing, you know, phrases that they use, like you will not replace us kind of thing.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of it is about fear.
You know, the so-called like the white genocide.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's a fear of that. And so in turn, then after that fear, I feel like that's when there is this play to try and get, try and self-marginalize in a way in order to gain some more power and privilege. Right, a lot of it's the fear of losing that power and privilege, right? Or just seeing their own lives and seeing like, actually my life hasn't felt all that privileged and I feel like I don't have any power. And yet everyone keeps telling me that. And so there's a very reactive, right, affect or feeling of like, now I have to like go against all of these people who are against me. When in fact, critical race theory to me is actually the opposite of that. It doesn't preach any of that stuff, or it doesn't really teach like that there are these sacred divisions, right? It actually, mm-hmm. part of the presumptions of critical race theory is that race is a process, and it's not really set in stone, and that race works differently in every city and every country. And so we can't think as restrictively about race as we might think.
That's definitely true. You know, like, I guess in the U.S. especially, the issue of race, you know, tends to be simplified, I guess, to very broad, very simplistic categories.
Yeah. And I think that there's strategy with that, right? Like, I am often identifying as Asian American, but I don't really, like, in my heart feel Asian American, you know, but part of it's because Asian American was invented in the, you know, about the same time as critical race theory in the 70s and late 60s. That term did not exist before then, but it was invented basically as a political project. You know,
so what was it back then, like before the 1970s?
It was like people were split more into different countries, like whatever mm-hmm. country they were from. And there were a lot of course, really bad terms like Orientals and things mm-hmm. like that. And so Asian American was a way of kind of creating solidarity, not only with each other as like, you know, having Japanese and Chinese diasporic or marginalized groups coming together and having solidarity and so on, and Filipinos. But it was also about thinking about Vietnam, which the U.S. was very much at war with at the time, and bombing. And so there was a solidarity political project that was Asian America when it first started. But nowadays, it's not really like that, right? It's mm-hmm. more about who we are, how we identify, who we see on screen representing us and so on. But it is really important to remember where that term comes from and like why it started, right? It was a leftist political anti-imperial mm-hmm. project. And it kind of shows you how corporations and the state can very quickly, within like a generation, completely change what a word means and take away its political power and its teeth, right? And so as someone who identifies as Asian American and teaches like Asian American, Asian Canadian studies, those things... we can always try and take the word back, right? We can mm-hmm. tell students like, this is where it comes from. You know, students had to boycott classes. They had to occupy buildings and so on in order to kind of frame this word. So that it comes out of protest as well. And we have to remember those histories. And so critical race theory, again, is part of the way of remembering histories that have been lost and have been not before, I guess, they get gentrified.
That's true. We'll be right back here on Research Review after one short message.
This week on the Arts Report, film, theater, dance, books, visual art, and more. Every Wednesday at 5 p.m., the Arts Reporters explore what's fun, fascinating, campy, or critical in the Vancouver art scene. You can find bonus content on our Mixcloud, Facebook, and Twitter. Got an idea for a review, interview, or original production? Email arts@citr.ca. Listen Wednesdays at 5 p.m. or anytime on citr.ca.
You're listening to Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM, and today we are interviewing Dr. Christopher Patterson. In the past bit, we've talked about some movements recently in society regarding race and also a bit about the terminology that is used at times. So the term Asian American, I guess it refers to a conglomeration of different ethnicities, right?
Yeah.
And it includes, for example, it includes South Asians as well, right?
Yeah.
In its official definition as well.
Yeah, and in Canada, that you're getting me to talk about things that are a bit like, sensitive, because in Canada, the South Asian population as a percentage is much higher than in the US, and partially because of the Commonwealth, of it being a Commonwealth country. And so not to say that there is insignificant in the US, it's very significant in the US. But that Canada and a lot of Commonwealth countries have a lot more South Asian population as a percentage of what we might call like Asian migrants or Asian diasporic peoples. And so there are like Asian Canadian, for example, because a lot of it is somewhat copy paste from Asian American. And Asian American focuses so much on Japanese and Chinese and East Asians. South Asians can very much be left out of the conversation when it comes to Canada, right? And so that's an example of how, like, taking a word that's been somewhat gentrified and then using it. Not to say that people are uncritical in using it. I know a lot of folks who teach Asian Canadian studies who are very, like, adamant about, like, how we need to include all people from Asia when we talk about this. But I think when it gets taken up in an everyday term, in an everyday way, South Asians are often excluded or just marginalized in that, in talking about it, and as well as like Filipinos and other kind of South and Southeast Asian peoples. And so, so that's an example of how, I think one thing that could happen with critical race theory is in the efforts to defend it, it could also become kind of sanitized and start to exclude people it didn't originally mean to exclude, right? It could be then copy and pasted onto different countries, even though it's centered so much on American context, it could be reused and taken up in other countries in a way that then doesn't really adjust to the context that it's in.
Yeah, that's the thing. You know, in Canada, I guess we often notice a lot of cultural imports from the U.S. For example, like the term Asian in U.S. and, you know, even Canada, increasingly like, people use the term Asian to like almost exclusively refer to like East Asians. Whereas it was interesting for me to see that in the United Kingdom, again, because of like different history there, the term Asian is predominantly used to like refer to South Asians. So like Pakistanis, Indians, Bangladeshis. That's basically, if someone says Asian, that's what comes into like someone's mind.
And I mean, part of it's also a class thing here too. Just statistically, not like on an individual level, of course, but like East Asians make more money than South Asians, have more presence because they've also been here much longer. Like as a whole, right? Like we can't be afraid of statistics, right? This, these things are real. Whereas South Asians are much more vulnerable, make less money, do a lot of the service work. We're much more vulnerable to COVID, COVID-19 and so on. And so it's moments like that when we have a pandemic or something that's that makes some people much more vulnerable than others, that terms like Asian Canadian really need to be kind of reassessed, right? Because, we've lived with the kind of privileging of certain types of Asian identities for so long. It wasn't a huge deal. It was always a bit classist and weird. But then when events happen that the people who are the most subject and vulnerable to those things become also hidden within the discourse itself, that then becomes... it can be quite a violent outcome, right? German, is, I see you like shaking your head or nodding sometimes. Like, do you have any thoughts on this?
Oh yeah. I just wanted to make sure we had some time to pivot our conversation, talk about some of your other work before you had to leave. I wanted to talk about your book, Open World Empire. So like as a gamer myself.
Okay, sure. Yeah, we can pivot. Yeah.
Yeah, if that's okay with you, if you have any other final thoughts on the matter.
Yeah, or Alira, did you have any?
No more thoughts. It was a pretty good conversation, so I guess Grimani can take it away.
Yeah, like as a gamer myself, I loved that you wrote the book Open World Empire, which focused mainly on video games with respect to race and imperialism. Could you maybe start by first elaborating what personally inspired you to write this work?
Well, like you, I play a lot of games and stuff. And so that was, and I started reading game studies pretty when I was an undergrad. I was just hanging out in the library all the time because I was in Las Vegas and my aircon would constantly break down. And so I just ended up living in the library a lot of the time, in the university library. And so I would just cruise around and I realized there are books written about games. So I started to read them and I just kept reading them, even though I worked on mostly literature when I was a graduate student. And I just kept thinking, like, I don't like the way that people talk about games in academia. It just seems really weird and not very interesting. I don't see a lot of the fun that I get from games. So I wanted to write a book that was like both kind of fun and silly and weird, and assessed a lot of the things about games that people don't like to talk about, right? Like the fact that most games and game genres come from Japan. People, of course, who play a lot of games know this and, you know, find it probably a good thing. Whereas a lot of game studies scholars who are from Europe and North America choose to conveniently ignore this fact whenever they talk about games. Like they don't talk about a game as something that's been translated, for example, for them, for Westerners, and or that have been censored or, you know, taken out certain things for Westerners. And then game studies people also tended to ignore the fact that a lot of gamers are just kind of Asiatic, or that they like to cosplay and they like to like do things that are very associated with Asia and with Japan specifically. And so I wanted to just kind of write about that. Like, and I think a lot of people didn't want to talk about that because they didn't want to be accused of being racist, or they didn't want to like make it look like gamers were appropriating Japanese culture or anything like that. And I also don't think that's happening either. But I feel like there needed to be ways of talking about how games are so Asian, right? When nobody wants to talk about it, without just saying like, oh, everyone who plays games is racist or anything like that. And so that was the basic like impetus behind that book, was like, how do we talk about games as Asian products? You know, where Japan is kind of the Hollywood of games. How do we deal with that without just kind of talking about appropriation or racism in a very surface level way? Like, how do we understand our play, how we play and how we practice, and like, yeah, how do we exist with these objects, and how does it change us?
Yeah, that's totally true. Like when I think about some of the more like even American-esque games I play, like Call of Duty or God of War or whatever, like they're made or produced or written by like American companies. But once you go to like the manufacturing, distribution and the head companies, they're all pretty much Asian. And no one ever really talks about that. It's never really something I thought about until it was brought up.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and it's very obvious when you're in Asia or certain spaces in Asia and you just see so much manufacturing, so much labor that's connected to games. Either in factories or in like, you know, people playing games professionally, either in an esports way or in like, you know, a gold, what is it called? The gold mining kind of ways of like, if you play a game like World of Warcraft, there'll sometimes be people who are playing in order to get certain objects and then sell them for like real world money, and things like that. And so you just confronted a lot more with the labor regimes around games. When you're there, I was in Nanjing in China for 2.5 years, for 2 years, and I lived in Hong Kong for 2.5 years. And so it was like there that it was just like stunningly obvious to anyone that even if a game, for like you're saying, has no representations of Asia, doesn't have any Asian or Asian diasporic people who make it, who design it, there are still Asian hands in factories who like build the hardware that allow those things to be played. And so on. And so, yeah, that was like, they're all kind of connected in one way or the other. And some are much more connected than others. But yeah, they're all somewhat Asian. I use the term Asiatic in the book to talk about games. Like, right. Games are Asiatic products.
And I believe you also touched a bit on how, as an Asian male, you're sort of seen as like accepted in this gaming community. I can sort of see that in myself as well. It was one of those spaces where I was seen as welcome, or it was like a space where Asians almost had privilege in a way. And I was wondering if you could elaborate a bit on that.
Yeah, definitely. It is a way that I felt, especially as an Asian male, I should say too, right? That there's, I don't know if I would call it privilege, because it's also a kind of exotification and somewhat of a fetish too, that like Asian men can't be good at any sport besides games, besides esports.
Yeah.
Right. And then people look at esports stars and they are not like attractive in a North American sense, right? A North American norm of what like a male beauty is. Most esports players are not that, whereas other sports players are. And so I'm always like weird about how to feel when like I don't even tell somebody I play games, but they can assume that I do just based on my background and the way I look. And that was definitely a thing growing up, was like people would assume that I was always good at games, even if I wasn't, especially other men who liked games. And I remember some of my white friends would tell me like that I was very lucky to be Asian because I could just play games better. Like I could beat people at games. And I was like, that's first of all, not true at all. But second, like, would it really be worth it to be Asian just so you could like play games well? That seems like a lot to like change about yourself in order for a very small outcome, even if that were true. So yeah, it was a weird thing to kind of grow up with, but it's definitely informs the book very heavily of like how games are kind of colored as Asian, and the way a lot of sports are become associated with particular types of people or like populations. And there's been a lot written about that, like how basketball, for example, you know, used to be a white, everything used to be a white dominated sport, right? but basketball used to be, and boxing, and the frustrations and fears over when those sports started to change, right? The people who played them and were experts started to change. It hasn't really been much of a tension thing in games, because games are so heavily associated with Asia that people just assume, of course, Asian people from Asia will be better at them. But it could very likely happen in some way. But it's definitely a privilege I would always put in quotation marks, because it has its backlashes as well.
Definitely. We'll be right back here on Research Review after one short message.
Red Cat Records is an amazing artist-owned and operated record store. Shop from their diverse online music collection and get free shipping within Vancouver and the Lower Mainland with the purchase of two or more LPs. If you would like to further support them through the evolving COVID-19 crisis, you can do so by buying a gift card to use at a later date. Visit www.redcat.ca for more information.
You're listening to Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM. We are interviewing Dr. Christopher Patterson today, and in the past bit, we've been talking a bit about Dr. Patterson's research on video games. I guess, like, yeah. There's this other aspect in gaming as well, like, in addition to the race thing, there's also the, like, the gender and the masculinity thing as well. Like, I remember, I'm not too familiar with this, but a few years ago, there was this thing called the Gamergate conspiracy.
Mm-hmm. Yep. That was in 2013, 2014. And it's basic, like a lot of, there have always been like queer and marginalized players in games. But it was always dominated as if it was only white men who played mm-hmm. them. And not necessarily white either, but mostly just men. Mm-hmm. And so advertisements, of course, were always geared towards men. And there's a weird history to this that like, this isn't necessarily true in some countries, because in the United States, and I believe in Canada as well, most of the toy aisles had like sections for boys and sections for girls. And so like a lot of games just ended up in the section for boys because they had to choose one. And so that's, so games just became associated with a boys thing, basically because just that was the categories that were in the children's stores. But in some countries, that wasn't the case. In some countries, in some places in Japan, for example, there are almost equal amounts of women and male players. But actually, nowadays, even the statistics are starting to even out, where there's, I think, like 35 to 40% of people who play games identify as women. It's just that given the changes in the demographics, it hasn't really reflected in, like, you know, quote unquote, game culture. So like game culture still sees itself as predominantly male, predominantly white as well. And so having to reimagine themselves as something else, you know, I think they believe that games were like a refuge from the world of politics and feminism mm-hmm. and all that stuff. And that like, this was the last refuge for like men to just go and be abusive to each other and like pretend to shoot each other in the face. And I think a lot of it was actually homoerotic. If you ever go into the homoerotic, but meaning that like there are erotic tenses in something that isn't seen as homosexual or gay, right? But I do remember, like, in the US gaming, especially in like first person shooter games, especially men will squat on each other.
Oh yeah.
Right. Once they kill somebody, they'll just squat on them, and it's called like teabagging, and there's a lot of different things for it, but it's very erotic. Right. And I think there was something queer and erotic about those spaces, that once they started to get disrupted, they became just very, you know, like restrictive and very conservative and just about, you know, casting out the others who didn't belong. Which is really unfortunate, because again, like women and queer people and other marginalized people have always played games, and they've always been part of they've always been participating in it. And so it was a reckoning that really needed to happen, though, after many, many years of people feeling like left out. It was really a matter of time and just had to happen eventually.
Oh yeah, definitely. Sure. Definitely in my own like personal experience, I know in gaming culture, it's still definitely male dominated. A lot of the voices you still see in the gaming community are definitely very male and usually the most outspoken bunch of the group. And it's very prevalent misogyny in gaming that still exists. And I was wondering why that is, even as females do become more prevalent in the gaming community.
Well, they're very broken up by genre.
Yeah,
I think that's part of it. And by how much the game cares about them, I guess, or sees itself as sees them as the audience. So a lot of first person shooters are very male dominated, and they're very like militaristic. So they're also quite like, you know, invested in the US state and military for whatever reasons, and more conservative leaning. So there's particular like game franchises out there that just own it and like go with, you know, a kind of Fox News like view of the world, I guess. And so they don't care that they're not a welcoming space at all for women and queer people and other marginalized people. That's not who they're trying to cater to. And then other games like something like Animal Crossing, for example, right? It's just a safer place. It's a more fun place. And they've actually like ingrained that in the way that you play the game, where you can only invite like, I think it's like 8 or 9 of your friends to come and join you and have and play with you, as opposed to being on a public server where anybody could go to your island and things like that. And so a lot of the designers just like realize that they need to accommodate the audience and the players a bit better. And sometimes it gets really wonky. Like I play Overwatch a lot, and I write about Overwatch in the book. And I notice whenever they have big sales and like big events, the community turns incredibly toxic, and there's all of these like horrible players who come in and just say the worst things. And it's because they haven't played Overwatch in a long time, or they're new to the game, so they don't realize that like they'll get reported very quickly. So there's always like this house cleaning that happens whenever there's a big sale. All the trolls will come in, and then they'll be cleaned out after like a month. But for like a month, Overwatch will be a horrible place to be in. And then it gets better, and then every game is just like, good game, everybody, that was fun, and people are complimenting each other, until the next big sale comes along, and then everyone just knows, like, stay out of the game for a month, you know, let the trolls do their troll thing. Or if you're like me, I try to just join games and just report everybody, so I'm like one of those people who just, like, rapidly reports, and hopefully that those people get kicked, and then they don't come back. Yeah, because and I think Blizzard has also lost a lot of money. I think because their audience has shrunk so much for that game. But it's also something that like the players, you know, the people who play it casually and have been playing it for like 5 years now, they wouldn't play it if it were as toxic as other shooting games. And so it's like one of the least toxic shooting games, but it still gets pretty toxic sometimes because of those sales and being unable to kind of account for, you know, streams of new people coming in.
Yeah, definitely. Like, I know the first-person shooter community is probably the most toxic, at least in my experience. I know that, like, when the Battlefield 5 trailer came up, for example, like, people absolutely lost it once they saw, like, a female soldier in the trailer. And that just became a huge sticking point for absolutely no reason.
Yeah. Unfortunately, games are, like, 10 or 15 years behind, at least, most media. And part of it's just the fact that you can have huge player bases in one game who don't play a lot of other games, and so they think that this is what games are, you know, and then that becomes a very toxic like place that just kind of reproduces itself, right? Because you have all these pockets, and so every game you choose to play, if it's online especially, it has different cultures attached to it. There was a long time where I was playing this game called Guild Wars 2. I don't know if any of you have played it, but it's known for having like much more progressive-ish kind of players and groups. And like the Final Fantasy, there's a Final Fantasy Online game too, where people can play and not have to deal with the toxicity of some other games. And so it's hard for like, if you're like me and you love, you know, first-person shooters, but you're also like a social justice professor, you know, and you really don't want to be called anything bad, or you don't want to just like deal with that, because that's one reason I only play Overwatch now, because it's the least toxic of all the toxic stuff. And I wish that there was a way that I could play first person shooters without having to deal with it, but it's just not really a thing, at least here. Like, I used to play in Hong Kong when Overwatch first came out for like the first 2 years, and it was great. Like, there was If there was toxicity, it was usually in a language I didn't understand. most of the, like, I didn't realize how toxic they could get in North America. And so when I wrote about it in Open World Empire, the first chapter is on Overwatch. You might not recognize some of the game stuff in it because, you know, it's me like having a lovely time with a fun community of people. And then, of course, I moved here and I was like, that community is much harder to find in Vancouver, or like in North America, where most of the people playing are not as friendly. So it also depends on where you're playing it, too.
Yeah, that's totally fair. We're coming to the end of our time here, so I just wanted to wrap things up quickly. I guess the one thing I took away from this podcast is fear is the path to the dark side, and I will remember that. Alirad, do you have any last thoughts before we wrap it up?
No, it's a very, very interesting conversation. I guess I think we touched on two pretty cool topics. First, we talked about the critical race theory, and later talking about video games and how that intersects with societal issues. So, pretty nice conversation, and thanks for joining us
today. Yeah, I'll just say one more thing about just one thing to students who are returning to UBC in September, you know, back to the critical race theory subject, which is, you know, be prepared and take care of yourself and others, and try to recognize, you know, if somebody is like bringing up some of these what would you call it, like dumb things to say about critical race theory. You know, try to like figure out, are they coming from a place where they've heard this on the radio or something, and they're just curious and they kind of want you to disprove them, you know, because this is what they were told by their parents or uncle, crazy uncle or something like that. Or are they actually attacking you and don't see you as a human being and all that? Like, there are differences that you can kind of try and assess between someone who's actually curious and wants to know more, versus someone who's trying to just attack you. And be prepared for both, because it is coming to UBC. Like, these things always come into the classroom in various ways. And it's also not your job exactly to educate somebody for it, but I think it is a type of relation, right? Someone might be using these dumb things that they've heard online or on TV or something to try and relate to you, because they don't really know how else to bring up these subjects. And so be prepared for all sorts of things. I think we're going to have some charged classrooms, as we did, you know, during COVID. But it's all part of the education and learning process. And so I hope that people bear with it and prepare for it and take care of themselves.
Definitely.
Yep. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Great.
This concludes our interview with Dr. Christopher Patterson on Research Review. Thank you for listening to CITR 101.9 FM.